It's Monday, January 23rd, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. Coming up on the show today, Walmart Stores Incorporated launches a nationwide contest to discover new products. An award-winning country music singer and songwriter Bill Rice will be featured on today's Arkan Songs. Also on the show today, museums in Fort Smith form a consortium, and we begin the Chinese New Year by celebrating the Year of the Dragon in our own special way. But first, Lincoln School District was approved this month by the Arkansas Board of Education to convert its high school to a charter school starting next year. But exactly what is a conversion public charter school? How is it different from an independent open enrollment charter school? And why would a public school seek such a change? Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Lincoln Consolidated School District is constructing a brand new $14 million, 115,000 square foot high school facility on Highway 62 east of town, slated to open next fall under a new conversion public school charter.
A lot of people think it's probably a good idea to kind of change up the American high school, you know?
Clay Hendricks is also going through a change. Current assistant superintendent will assume the superintendent's position next year.
Lincoln is located in western Washington County on Highway 62, bordered by the Oklahoma State border. And we have about 1,200 students right now. We vary somewhere between 1,200 and 1,300 typically in the last several years. We have about 72% of our students that qualify for free and reduced lunch, so that kind of describes our poverty level.
But Hendricks says his district offers a wealth of enthusiastic instructors striving to teach a rich curriculum. The district is transitioning to Common Core, a new nationally shared framework which uses collaborative learning and technology to boost achievement and meet global education standards. But it sought to change even more. So in early January, the State Board of Education agreed to let Lincoln School District create a conversion public charter high school, grades 8 through 12.
A conversion charter school is a public school that exists that's a part of a district. And the administration and the board of that district make the decision to convert that existing school into a charter school. And so that's where the name conversion charter school comes from. And a charter school is a school that has a contract with the State Board of Education. And there's two parts to the contract. One part is these are the laws and the rules and the standards that we would like a reprieve from, or we'd like to modify, or we'd like to not follow. And then this is what we're going to do if you allow us to break these rules.
For example, Lincoln will do away with a semester of required oral communication because it's implicit in the conversion charter's new tech curriculum. Students will collaborate on all sorts of multimedia projects, presenting the results to class.
One of the big changes that students at the high school will see is blended courses. And a blended course is pretty easy to understand. You have two classes. And for instance, a good example is 10th grade English and world history. And they're in a large room for two class periods. They get taught, you know, the skills and the content they need for both classes. Basically, you know, the world history content is taught, you know, using the standards of English.
The conversion high school will adhere to current Arkansas curriculum framework standards, as well as the new Common Core, but with a new tech twist.
2 years ago, all of the students showed up with laptops, you know, because we got laptops for all of our kids in grades 3 through 12. And so that was quite a change for them then. And I think to some extent, there's been a lot of searching for more things for kids to do with those devices instead of listen to teachers, and so this fits in really well with that.
Basically, the days of lectured reading, writing, and arithmetic are way over.
You know, part of the new tech initiative is that students work on those projects every day. And it is a change from the model of, you know, you teach, you do some practice, the teacher teaches, the student learns, you do some practice in class, you do homework, and you come back, and you repeat that until you take a test. And so in that more traditional model, there are some students that didn't do homework, and they didn't have to, and they did pretty well on the test, and they had pretty good grades. But in the new tech model, where students work in teams on projects to produce some type of authentic product, there's really not so much homework. And there's really no place to slough off and not do homework. You know, there's no place to hide. And your teammates are going to figure out real quick that you're not doing your work. And so those students who are really bright kids, you know, they're really bright kids. You know, they complain to their parents some. Like, you know, they say things like, oh, the teacher's not teaching anymore. And it's like, well, the teacher's not talking all period anymore.
Teachers here 2 years ago began test teaching new tech blended courses. So next year's curriculum won't be so foreign to faculty, students, or parents.
They like being better teachers. You know, they like improving the quality of their own instruction. And this is the professional development for new tech is pretty good. And so they get some real solid examples of what to do, and they get some things to watch.
But applying to become a conversion public charter school is not easy.
When you apply for a conversion charter school, you do address all of those needs, you know, staffing, the educational need, the prior student achievement, a variety of things. You address a lot of those things in the application. And that's quite lengthy. You know, they're looking for lots of evidence, lots of documentation. And they evaluate that application, and they send it back to you, and then you write a response to the evaluation, and then you go before a review council, and you bring even more documentation that they've requested in the interim, and then from that you get some more feedback, and then you actually get to present to the State Board of Education.
Lincoln School District, which is 80% white, 20% Hispanic, Pacific Islander, and Asian, will now join 11 existing conversion public charters in Arkansas, and 3 new ones also just approved. No open enrollment private charter schools were approved last cycle. Misty Newcomb is Chief of Staff for the Office of Education Policy at the University of Arkansas.
So the difference between a conversion charter school and a public charter school is in an open enrollment charter school is essentially who runs the school. So conversion charter schools are run by the district where they reside, and open enrollment charter schools are privately run, usually by nonprofit organizations.
Newcomb says districts seek to convert because they want to do something innovative or change to an alternative learning environment to attract at-risk kids. Some states allow districts to submit curriculum waivers. Arkansas does not, but it does offer the charter conversion option.
One other reason that schools often convert to conversion charter schools is because of the AYP accountability requirements and No Child Left Behind. Once a school gets to a certain level, around year 5 or 6 in school improvement, so pretty deep into the school improvement system, they have to make drastic changes. One such change is converting to a charter school.
Arkansans are divided on open enrollment charter schools, which opponents say can be elitist, exclusionary, and even racially divided. So will the adoption of conversion public charter schools change some minds?
I don't see how that's helpful for the movement. It doesn't increase parental choice. It doesn't increase innovation. And it doesn't really change the structure or the governance systems of schools.
Newcomb says conversion public charter schools don't increase school choice nor truly provide for major innovation. But she did say one reason districts may apply for a conversion charter is funding. Lincoln School District will receive over $500,000 in federal grants to help cover their transition. Lincoln School District Assistant Superintendent Clay Hendricks said some of the parents are skeptical about the change, but he feels confident it will help students progress.
There is a stigma, you know, about charter schools from people that are supporters of public education. I happen to be a supporter of public education. But to do the things that we wanted to do, which wasn't to wreck, you know, the American high school, but just to try to innovate on it and improve some on it, we had to have some more flexibility from just this, you know, the status quo rules and regulations. And that was our motivation for converting the school to a charter school.
And this will be the second conversion public charter school for Lincoln School District. It converted its alternative learning center for at-risk 9th through 12th grade students to an academic center of excellence in 2008.
And at that time, we were looking for the maximum flexibility for families. Sometimes families, you know, really need a lot of support and flexibility to help get their kids through school, specifically graduated, you know, from high school. Lincoln had the lowest graduation rate in the area in the years preceding that. And immediately after opening that school, we had the highest graduation rate, and we've maintained a very high graduation rate. So we feel the school is very successful in that manner.
And while the district's middle and high school students for a time lagged in meeting adequate yearly progress under No Child Left Behind, as have many across the nation, Hendricks said students are now caught up. And the district's high school graduation rate? In the low 90% range. Next fall, Lincoln Public School District's incoming superintendent, Clay Hendricks, will learn firsthand if the conversion charter high school works. His eldest son is entering eighth grade. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Arkansas passed a public charter school law in 1995, joining 39 states around the nation with the first conversion public charter school opening in 2001. To learn more, visit arkansased.org/schools/charters. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. In an effort to promote creativity and discover some great products that don't often make it to store shelves, Walmart Stores Incorporated has launched Get on the Shelf, a nationwide contest that anyone can enter provided their product falls under a category currently covered by Walmart. The winning product will then be sold in Walmart stores across the country. The project is an initiative of Walmart Labs, a Silicon Valley-based subdivision that combines retail, social, and mobile commerce. Chris Bolte is the vice president of Walmart Labs. He says the contest was officially launched last week and has been gaining momentum steadily.
You know, I think we're always looking for ways that we can discover how to best use social technology and bridge that with e-commerce. And given the massive amount of products out in the world today, and how strong consumers feel about and the passion they have about products, we felt this was a great example to kind of, you know, bridge those two things and create a new contest that folks could have a lot of fun with.
Bolte says the only requirement to enter the Get on the Shelf contest is that the product fall under a category currently covered by Walmart in its stores or online. The participation process is very simple and is open to anyone, including individuals and small to medium-sized businesses.
And we've tried to make that submission process very, very simple. Where anyone can just go on the website, Get on the Shelf, and submit their product idea plus video. There's a very quick screening process to make sure that the product would fall within one of our represented categories at Walmart. And we are allowing submissions through the end of February, and then the contest will close. I'm sorry, the submission portion will close, and then voting will start. And anyone can vote, and there's a simple voting button, a vote now button on the website.
The fate of a product will depend on the number of votes it receives. The first stage of the consumer voting process will eliminate all but 10 that receive the highest number of votes. These top 10 products will then be moved to the second stage of consumer voting.
And from that second stage, we will pick and identify or pick the top three products based on total consumer votes that are happening again on the shelf. And those top three will be the winners. And the number one winner will be the grand prize winner. Again, all based on the consumer votes. And that is the product that will then get onto the Walmart offline store shelves. But all three will get placement and incorporated in and promotion on Walmart.com.
The contest is an inexpensive shortcut for low-budget product developers to see their items on Walmart store shelves, a process that is otherwise very thorough and complex and works as follows. A potential supplier submits a proposal to Walmart. The application is then reviewed and forwarded to the appropriate store buyer. The buyer may then choose to meet the potential supplier or request more information regarding the product. After further review, the buyer may place an order or decline to do business. If an order is placed, the potential supplier needs to meet several requirements, some of which may cost a significant amount of money. Chris Bolte of Walmart Labs says the retail giant will work with the individuals or businesses associated with the winning products to make sure they can meet the store demands.
So I think our involvement just is really beginning at that point, quite frankly. Given that you know, many of these product submissions that we're seeing come from small to medium-sized businesses or even individuals, and we want to incent that, there might be some challenges for these small, medium-sized businesses or individuals to meet the demand that Walmart can drive for their product. So we'll be working closely with them to provide any kind of support that they need in terms of production scale or distribution so that they can actually meet that demand that we can offer them.
The contest has received nearly 70 entries thus far for all kinds of products. For instance, the ePillow lets you use your tablet computer comfortably. An adaptable lets you adapt your swimming pool bowl into a high-reach tool. An oven rag guard protects your forearms while you're operating the oven.
Pot holders and mitts protect your hands, but leave your arms exposed to injury. Now there's a solution. The Oven Rack Guard from Jazz Innovations. It snaps on in just seconds, providing instant protection against accidental oven burns. Made from the same high-tech fabric worn by firefighters.
The Get on the Shelf contest was launched by Walmart Labs to give millions of Walmart consumers the opportunity to select a product with the help of a unique platform that combines social, retail, and mobile commerce. The Walmart Labs subdivision was founded nearly 6 months ago when the retail giant bought a Silicon Valley startup called Cosmix.
The overall charter is around technology and product innovation, and the merge, you know, how mobile, social, and e-commerce come together. And so there are a number of different initiatives within Walmart Labs, whether it be on the technology side or product side or mobile side, of how we are trying to help Walmart move to the next level in technology and online commerce and better connect with its user base.
In addition to launching the Get on the Shelf contest, Walmart Labs recently launched a shopping application for Facebook called ShopeeCat to help Walmart consumers find gifts for family and friends based on the preferences stated on their social media pages.
It's a Facebook application, and it's a gift recommendation application. And so what ShopeeCat is able to do is when you download that app on Facebook, we're able to understand, connect up to your Facebook profiles and provide relevant gift recommendations for your friends for any kind of holiday or birthday celebration. And so engagement has been great. We've gotten over 120,000 different consumers who have downloaded the app. The time spent on the app is in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 minutes. And, you know, people seem to really be enjoying it.
On being asked about the significance of the contest to Walmart, Bolte had this to say.
Well, I think while we have a very thorough and complex merchandising selection system right now, what we wanted to do was, you know, and we carry, you know, many, many different products today. There's literally millions of products out there, and when we feel that we may have been, you know, potentially missing something. So we'd love to open up that, you know, open up the aperture, open up the funnel, and identify and see some products that maybe we haven't yet seen. Or perhaps maybe we passed over and consumers are telling us, hey, this is something that should be on the shelves at Walmart. And I think the other important thing is that this is the first time that we've really given our consumers a very strong voice in what else we should be carrying at Walmart. So that was a very, very important thing for us to do.
To learn more about Get on the Shelf, a nationwide contest launched by Walmart to discover new products, visit getontheshelf.com.
Earth, sky.
Most people hear what they know about climate change from a politician, from a headline, from a soundbite, from a joke in the bar. They don't know where to go to get the real information.
You're listening to climate scientist Gavin Schmidt of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Dr. Schmidt researches the variability of ocean circulation and climate using state-of-the-art computer models. Earth Sky's over 1,000 science advisors selected Gavin Schmidt as the Earth Sky Science Communicator of the Year.
The one thing that people still ask me, is climate change real? And is it caused by us? And the answer to both of those things is yes. It's happening now, and as far as we can tell, most of the climate changes right now are being driven by human activities.
Earth Sky asked Dr. Schmidt what he's trying to achieve in communicating more broadly to people beyond just other scientists.
Climate change is a problem that scientists have brought to the public's attention. People, I think, are rightly very confused about what's really going on. There's a huge need for people who know what they're talking about to input their expertise into that conversation.
We have more with Gavin Schmidt at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. If you haven't been able to keep up with the latest in business news, Roby Brock from our content partner docbusiness.net is back with a recap of the last 7 days in business.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. On the 5-year anniversary of the El Dorado Promise, a new study shows how the scholarship program has impacted trends in the South Arkansas School District. In January 2007, Murphy Oil announced it would contribute $50 million over 10 years to help graduates of El Dorado Public Schools go to college tuition-free. 5 years later, a study conducted by the Office of Education Policy at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville showed the following trends. El Dorado Public Schools have seen a 5% increase in student enrollment, whereas neighboring school districts from Texarkana to Crossett have seen 5% to 14% declines. El Dorado Promise leaders said that if pre-2007 trends continued, El Dorado Public Schools would have lost an additional 200 students. Also, 80% of eligible high school graduates, or about 780 students, have used the El Dorado Promise scholarship program. Walmart stores announced that current Sam's Club president and CEO Brian Cornell is leaving the wholesale unit and will be replaced by Rosalind Brewer, effective February 1st. Brewer was most recently president of the Walmart U.S. Eastern Business Unit, where she was responsible for more than $100 billion in annual revenue, 1,600 stores, and more than 500,000 workers. On the earnings front, three Arkansas banks posted profits this week. One-time items from a year ago affected Simmons First National's fourth quarter and full-year bottom lines, leading to lower earnings of $25.4 million for the Pine Bluff-based bank holding company. Home Bancshares, parent company of Centennial Bank, reported net income for the year of $54.7 million compared to just $17.6 million 1 year ago. Home Bankshares has been on an acquisition spree for the last 2 years as it has gobbled up banks in northern Florida and a sliver of Alabama. And Bank of the Ozarks reported record net income of $101 million, a 58% increase for 2011. Bank of the Ozarks' fourth quarter net income was only up 3.8%, so the bank recorded most of its bottom line progress in the first and second quarters, when it incorporated profits from three key out-of-state acquisitions. And Schulze & Birch Biscuit Company, the Chicago-based manufacturer, said it has completed its acquisition of one-time Searcy-based Yarnell's Ice Cream from bankruptcy and hopes to have products on the shelves of grocery stores by this spring. Schulze & Birch said its management will begin meeting with retailers to present the Yarnell's product line with original formulas. It also said the process of reopening the Yarnell's plant in Searcy will begin immediately using some former Yarnell's employees. Now, don't expect production to ramp up to past levels of more than 200 workers. The new owners are planning a smaller-scale reintroduction of its ice cream products to the market. I'm Roby Brock, and this is your Talk Business Update.
Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at mitchellwilliamslaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks. More information at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity tablets for small businesses, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon communication store near you or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at cegpartners.com. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. The city of Fayetteville has announced plans to pave a final section of dirt trail around Lake Fayetteville, north of the city, beginning this summer. The Lake Trail is part of the city's popular multi-use 18-mile-long trail system, which began construction in 2002. Matt Mihalovich is Trails Coordinator for the city of Fayetteville.
The trail system around the lake currently is 4.5 miles, circling kind of the western side over the dam and then up the northern part around the Environmental Study Center and then back around to the Botanical Gardens, and extends a little bit heading back to the west, but we lack 1 mile of paved trail. There is the soft surface nature trail that does circle the lake, but some of the more difficult and challenging terrain is that last mile. So we plan to add the additional 10-foot wide paved trail connecting that last mile to Veterans Memorial Park.
A connector trail is also planned in the future to connect the Lake Fayetteville Trail to Skull Creek Trail. For now, hikers and cyclists must cut through residential and business districts to get from one to the other. Paving just 1 mile of the lake trail will cost around $500,000, but a portion of that will be paid via grant funding, Mihalovich says. The city trail emerges from the South Industrial District through the downtown all the way to the north side of town along various creeks and streams, many through city parks. Matt Mihalovich says the Lake Trail, adjacent to Veterans Memorial Park and the Botanical Gardens, is heavily used.
We've been counting it with our infrared counter, and on a typical average is about 500 people a day using that paved trail. So very significant use, one of our highest used, and next to Skull Creek Trail, the main backbone of our trail system, has the most use, but this is really close to about the same amount of use. Around 500 a day.
Eventually, the trail complex will be included in the 36-mile-long Razorback Regional Greenway Trail. Coming up, 4 Fort Smith museums are planning to band together for a number of collaborative projects starting next month. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums has the details.
Last week, representatives of 4 museums in downtown Fort Smith were walking around one of those museums, the Clayton House, planning for a collaborative effort that will take place early next month. The afternoon meeting was to prepare for a February 2nd education evening. the Clayton House, the Fort Smith National Historic Site, the Fort Smith Museum of History, and the U.S. Marshals Museum will work in tandem to explain to invited teachers from the Fort Smith School District the benefits their students could receive from a field trip at each site. The meeting last week, the education event next month, and more joint projects are the result of the Fort Smith Museum Consortium. Julie Moncrief is the executive director of the Clayton House. She says city museums working together is following a well-tested business model. There is a reason, she says, so many fast food restaurants appear on the same corner.
You gather them together, people will know about them and utilize them all. And Fort Smith just has such an amazing story with a few fantastic agencies that tell it so well that we want everyone to experience all of them, and we want to work together.
The four museums working together on the education evening all tell similar stories, how the city grew, but with different details. Each is part of a whole story. The museums have been working together on a bigger, more ambitious project as well. With funding from the Arkansas Humanities Council, a life and law project will be available to schools. Using a vast array of documents, first-person accounts, and historic photographs, each museum can help tell the significant role law enforcement has played in the city's history. Jessica Hayes, the Vice President of Operations for the U.S. Marshals Museum, says part of the inspiration for the project came from a teaching workshop 3 hours east in Melbourne, Arkansas.
And a teacher actually came up to me and said, I'm really excited about the Marshals Museum opening. Fort Smith will be a great place to bring my students, and when we come, we need a lot to do because we have to spend the night. It's such a drive. And that was a lot of the inspiration behind this, because as we started talking about it, we thought, well, what if we found the funding and we could go ahead and start bringing them now?
So there is money in the life and law funding to help classes from outside the immediate Fort Smith area be able to travel to the museums. The consortium also includes the Regional Art Museum in Fort Smith, the Trolley Museum located in downtown Fort Smith, and members of the Fort Smith Advertising and Promotions Commission. And the consortium is not solely focused on taking the message to young people. Caroline Spear, exhibit designer at the Fort Smith Museum of History, says working together can help spread the word that these opportunities are available to everybody.
We get people all the time in who, the museum has been here 100 years. 100 years! And we have people all the time who have lived here their entire life, grown up here, and come in and say, I had no idea this place was here. Didn't know.
Same with the National Historic Site.
We get the double whammy.
That's Michael Groomer, Chief of Interpretation at the Fort Smith National Historic Site.
They don't know that we're there, and they don't know we're part of the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. We are known as Judge Parker's Courthouse, plain and simple. Mm-hmm. So when I tell people I work for the National Historic Site, National Park Service, they'll say things like, you mean Hot Springs? I'm like, no, here in Fort Smith.
And that's what they know you all. They will call us and say, where's Judge Parker's?
Michael Groomer says beyond the outreach to schools, past the Rising Tide Lifts All Boats awareness campaign, regular meetings of the museums have been an aid to him for much more personal reasons. He's been working at the National Historic Site for just over a year after moving to the city from El Paso in December 2010.
And being connected to this group has been good for me because I'm working with people that have been here longer. They're well connected in the community, and they're great resources for me to call and say, hey, I need to work on this. You know, who can I call? Jessica's helped me so many times. She knows everybody, and she has their phone number. So that's been good for me. And then with working with the History Museum, as Lisa said earlier, we have the same visitors. The kids come to both. So it's just a great match. They come to our park, they go to the History Museum or vice versa. So working together in this capacity just seems very natural.
The joint projects have spurred discussions on how to reach even more people, including students who may not attend a school that schedules a field trip to the museums. Pat Schmidt, a park ranger at the National Historic Site, says the site is considering using the internet more.
So that it can be available to teachers who are not within driving distance, you know, so that it's available on a much broader spectrum to reach those who can't come in.
Other options include film presentations that could be found on YouTube. One of the first proposals to come out of the consortium was a volunteer fair held this past weekend. Michael Groomer with the National Historic Site says even though the participating museums in the consortium differ in affiliation from a federally run site to a city run agency, and even though there are differences in age, the Fort Smith Museum of History is a century old, the U.S. Marshals Museum, a work in progress, they all have similar challenges. And he says that's why a day-long fair to let people know about volunteering opportunities at several nonprofits in the city came out of that first museum consortium meeting.
Looking at the needs that each of the organizations or agencies, the things that we all face in common, one is that we have shrinking budgets, we have greater demands, and we have fewer people to do them. So volunteers play a key role, and we have some volunteers that volunteer at more than one place. We share volunteers. So working jointly together, we've put together this fair, and we'll have tables from each of the organizations, and people from the public, anyone can come and learn about what the agencies do, and if they don't want to volunteer, at least they'll learn about what the agencies do. So it's a great educational tool in general. Next year, we hope to expand even further and go regional. So it's a pretty great deal. We've had good response from it.
And Pat Schmidt, the park ranger at the historic site we heard from earlier, says each opportunity for outreach is a chance to ensure the history of Fort Smith will not only be known, but cared for.
By teaching about our history, we're also developing the future historians, the ones who will be able to continue telling the story when we're no longer at our jobs. You know, there's going to be someone who comes to replace us, and by getting them interested in history now, it could be one of our students who comes to see us today.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with ArkanSongs.
Girl next door in Oregon, she found a boy she liked. She wanted to get married, settle down in life. Girl next door in Oregon, she knew it wasn't right. She came home at past 10, late every night.
Wilbur Stephen Bill Rice was born in Datto in western Clay County on April 19, 1939. Coming from a musical family, Rice learned guitar from his mother while still a young teen. He went to high school in Corning and began to play music around the area. Original Elvis Presley guitarist Scotty Moore signed still-teenaged Bill Rice to Memphis's Fernwood Records. A couple of years later, Rice got a song he'd co-authored on 1960's Elvis's Back album. It was just the first of many songs the songwriting Arkansasian would place on other artists' albums.
We ain't done nothing wrong.
Things really picked up for Bill Rice as a songwriter when he met his longtime writing partner, Jerry Foster, a native of Tallapoosa, Missouri. Both worked at radio station KTCB in Malden, Missouri, while working on songs together and separately and playing clubs and dances around the Boot Hill area. An offer by fellow Clay County native Roland Janes of Brookings to record at his Memphis studio led to a songwriting contract for the partnership of Foster and Rice.
Yep, I promise you to straighten up and put my life in order. If I swear to you, woman, on bending knees, I won't hurt you again. If I become the kind of man that you want me to be,
years went on, country music hits began to pile up for Bill Rice and Jerry Foster, emerging favorite sons of Datto and Tallapoosa. The 1960s ended with the duo's song, The Backside of Dallas, as performed by Jeannie C. Riley, being nominated for a Grammy Award. Prosperity continued for Bill Rice through the 1970s. He had a number one song for Charlie Pride that was also nominated for a Grammy. Rice wrote another number one with his partner Foster for Jerry Lee Lewis, and through the decade, they wrote top 10 songs for Johnny Paycheck, Hank Williams Jr., and Mickey Gilley, among others. As a solo performer, Rice charted a few songs himself, including Traveling Minstrel Man, which broke the country top 40 in 1971. By the end of the 1970s, Bill Rice had formed another songwriting partnership with his then-wife, Sharon Vaughn Rice.
I know you can see I'm incredibly blue, but I'm not that lonely yet.
By the 1980s and 1990s, Bill Rice was the most award-winning songwriter in the history of music publishing giant ASCAP, also being six-time ASCAP Writer of the Year and additionally winning an award from BMI, ASCAP's rival. In 1994, Rice and Foster were inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. Along the way, Bill Rice songs have been recorded by performers from Sonny and Cher to Robert Goulet. Meanwhile, back in Datto, population of less than 100, the town honored its successful native son by naming one of its thoroughfares Bill Rice Street. Here in its entirety is Bill Rice of Datto in Western Clay County with his Grammy-nominated number one country song from 1970, Wonder Could I Live There Anymore, performed by Charlie Pride.
Have you ever been awakened by the crowing of a rooster while the night dew is still heavy on the ground and the voice of Uncle Ben seems to break the morning silence, bringing lights to windows all around? Well, it's time to rise and shine, start another hard work day, and get the cows in and start the milking chores. It's nice to think about it, maybe even visit, but I wonder could I live there anymore. About the smell of cornbread cooking on a wood stove seems to bring a picture to my mind of a little three-room house with Mama in the kitchen, but she can't stop to talk, ain't got the time. She's a fixing Daddy's supper, he's a working overtime, trying to pay our bill at the grocery store. It's nice to think about it, maybe even visit, but I wonder could I live there anymore. Think about my childhood and of my old hometown. I don't really miss them like before. It's nice to think about it, maybe even visit, but I wonder could I live there anymore.
Grammy-nominated number one song, Wonder Could I Live There Anymore, sung by Charlie Pride in 1970 and written by acclaimed songwriter Bill Rice of Datto in Western Clay County. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
It's Monday, the 23rd of January, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madholkar, and with me is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, here's your pop quiz.
Okay.
You know, we had a pop quiz with Kyle on Sunday that was kind of terrifying.
Yes.
So here's terrifying. Your pop quiz. What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, my God. That's such a difficult question. I can go on and on
lots
about
lots of
that.
Everything?
Yes, lots of everything.
Do you listen to country?
Not that much.
I don't understand country. I try. I understand that a lot of people really like George Strait. Okay. And I understand that he is going to be at the BOK Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma on February 16th, and at the Scott Trade Center in St. Louis on February 17th, and at the Sprint Center in Kansas City, Missouri on February 25th. And you should look at georgestrait.com to find out more.
Okay. I know what I do like.
What?
One band I do like is Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros.
And they're coming.
They're coming to Wakarusa, but they'll be around or near Northwest Arkansas on March 18th, I think.
So you can go see them before going to Wakarusa.
Yes, we might.
You don't look like a Wakarusa kind of girl.
That is correct.
Me either. But Kevin Kinder will tell us all about it, so it'll be just like we were there.
Okay, that works. Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Ithy. Happy Year of the Dragon to you.
Happy Year of the Dragon to you, too.
I did some research on people born in Years of the Dragon.
Okay.
Of course, Year of the Dragon starts today. There have been several Years of the Dragon in the past 100 years, mm-hmm. starting in 1904, and then every 12 years or so. And it's a variety of people,
okay.
a very eclectic mix, from Jimmy Dorsey to Dr. Seuss, Salvador Dali. Here now are voices
okay.
of people born, each a different voice, each born in a different Year of the Dragon. See how many of these you recognize.
I thought and hoped you could assist me. The ornament is a statuette, black figure of a bird. I am prepared to pay on behalf of the figure's rightful owner the sum of $5,000 for its recovery.
Yes, I'm a walking chilly wall. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need.
Well, the time is here. We've been through a lot together, through dark days and nights and seasons of hope and joy. Whatever the story, I had only one objective, to get it right. When I failed, it was personally painful, and there was no greater urgency.
The moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter.
Cedars, the days of troublesome scaling, cutting, and gutting are over, because Super Bassomatic 76 is the tool that lets you use the whole bass with no fish waste without scaling, cutting, or gutting. Here's how it works. Catch a bass, remove the hook, and drop the bass. That's the whole bass into the Super Bass.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone.
Here comes Meadowlark Lemon. He's never tried Charmin. Watch me get him.
This is very interesting.
So I know there are some that, because you did not grow up in the United States, mm-hmm. there are some that you would not recognize, especially that last
true.
One. I think even if you had grown up in the U.S., you'd be too young, perhaps, to know that last voice. But mm-hmm. there are people out there who know. So there were seven people,
mm-hmm.
all born in seven different Years of the Dragon. And I guess to find out just who they are, you can go to our website. Go to theozarksatlarge.com today.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Kyle.
No, you bet.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 23rd of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the French writer Stendhal, born in Grenoble, France, 1783, a psychological novelist more interested in his characters' inner lives than in their surroundings. He graduated from public school in his little town, went to Paris, got a job with Napoleon's war ministry, worked his way up, lived all over Europe, fell in love with women along the way. In Milan, in his late teens, he fell in love with Angela Pietragrua, a 23-year-old woman who later became the character of Gina Pietranera in The Charterhouse of Parma, his novel. He fell in love with Matilda Viscontini-Dembowski, the wife of a Polish general, who was smart, she was beautiful, she was unattainable. Stendhal followed her across Italy, trying to disguise himself in green glasses, loitering around the park where she walked, getting himself invited to the same parties she would be at. She let him come sit in her parlor and talk to her, but only once every 2 weeks, which nearly drove him crazy. In his book entitled On Love, he described the seven stages of falling in love, from admiration to pleasure to doubt to what he calls crystallization. He wrote, "Half, indeed, the most beautiful half of life is hidden from one who has not loved passionately." It's the birthday of the poet Derek Walcott, born on St. Lucia in the Caribbean in 1930, grew up reading Wordsworth, John Milton, Andrew Marvel, got a scholarship to study in Jamaica, then to study theater in the United States, then went back home and founded the Trinidad Theater Workshop. Taught at Boston University, became friends with Robert Lowell, and in 1990 published his epic poem Omeros, a retelling of Homer's Odyssey, set on St. Lucia. Derek Walcott, who said, "I come from a place that likes grandeur. It likes large gestures. It is not inhibited by flourish. It is a society of physical performance. It is a society of style. I grew up in a place in which if you learned poetry, you shouted it out. Boys would scream it out and perform it and flourish it. If you wanted to approximate that thunder or that power of speech, it couldn't be done by a little modest voice in which you muttered something to someone else. I come out of that society of the huge gesture, and literature is like that." Here's a poem for today by Charles Bukowski entitled The Click of Miracle. At the Quarter Horse meet at Hollywood Park around 5 p.m., if you are sitting at ground level in the pavilion, the track appears to be above you. And in the strange shadow sunlight, the silks are so bright, the color is like fresh paint on canvas, and the faces of the jocks look heroic. It's a grand time. Then a perfect and peaceful photograph, dreamlike. Such small moments keep people alive. Such small moments, so large, when it all comes together and holds. A poem by Charles Bukowski, The Click of Miracle, from Septuagenarian Stew, published by Black Sparrow Press, and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. Produced by Kathy Roach and written by Betsy Alistair. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The first annual Northwest Arkansas Fashion Week will be held Monday, March 5th through Saturday, the 10th at East Square Plaza on the Fayetteville Town Square. This event will feature fashion, jewelry, raffles, parties, and more. Proceeds to benefit charities throughout Northwest Arkansas. Tickets and more information are available on the web at nwafw.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Lincoln. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mutholkar. Thanks for listening and have a great day.